The following podcast contains scenes of graphic violence, abuse, assault, and, oh God, why am I doing this? Flying vaginas. Yeah. And I also lit this candle today, which someone gifted to me, and it does not really smell like anything, not even wax. So I don't know what that candle is all about. I was gonna do a self-burn when, like, I do not know what that candle is all about, much like this podcast. But then I thought I should not do that in the initiation start, since it's the 18th episode. And welcome, listener. The podcast is hosted by Koi. That's the end of the podcast. You can go. That's it. And hi, how are you? Today on the 18th episode, we are gonna have not fun. We are gonna talk about the Chicago Ripper crew. And I am excited for that. I just had a major anxiety / panic attack before just recording this, and yeah, we are here. And I'm very grateful to certain people in my life who calm me down most times and give me the hard love when I need to see it. And I want to thank you guys who listen to the podcast and give me validation. And talking about validation, tomorrow the validation episode comes out, so send in your stories, because you guys have not sent them in yet. Talking about send, you know, I should stop saying talking about send them in yet, whatever this, like, I should not be doing this because it's very pretentious and I don't want to do such pretentious transitions. Talking about pretentious transitions, let's go to fishy news. And today, the very first fishy news is amazing. Dinosaur carving found on Middle Age tomb proves evolution is wrong, claims a Bible expert. I mean, you had us in the first half, not gonna lie. I mean, I would have believed the entire article if they wouldn't have said Bible expert. Like, the things claimed by all beautiful little Bible experts are so amazing. Now I'm gonna read this huge ass article just to prove him wrong. The article says, although scientists are positive that dinosaurs ruled on Earth was cut short some 66 million years ago, young Earth's creationists beg to differ. According to certain interpretations of the biblical chronology, the planet's age can be determined by tracing the lineage of mankind by the creation of Adam and Eve in the Genesis to the birth of Jesus Christ in the New Testament. Young Earth creationists therefore estimate that our world is only about 6,000 to 10,000 years old, an estimate which at odds with the scientific estimate of 4.543 billion years. Yeah, these were the same people who said the Earth is flat, you know. And I love how they estimate, like, spans 4,000 years just, like, here and there. They are not sure. Okay, maybe 4,000 years here, maybe 4,000 years there. We are not sure, but okay, idiots. But you know what? It's all right. I don't judge people. Their belief is based upon the Bible, but not on the basis of inferences made by the scientists over the decades and centuries. I mean, they are obviously more correct. They are right, because since the religion always knows best. Oh my God, the amount of sarcasm that I keep on spewing around in this podcast. I know, right? These men nowadays. And oh, what it says, the evidence, this is the amazing part. The article says the evidence is, and I quote, a brass carving of a dinosaur-like creature adorning the tomb of an English bishop buried under the Middle Ages. Professor May explained, startling evidences had come to light which demonstrates that English artisans had the knowledge of what dinosaurs looked like as far as the end of Middle Ages. Okay. The possibility that this article is actually written by an ignorant human being, or maybe an American, is very high. I mean, these guys aren't even considering the possibility that there's a chance that the people would have discovered dinosaurs, or, you know, dinosaurs, the entire construction of a dinosaur is actually very monster-like. And unless and until it specifically said, okay, this is a dinosaur, this is the skeletal structure of it, it's not that. The Chinese have been talking about dragons and dinosaurs much before the West even thought about it. That does not mean that they excavated the dinosaurs. That simply means that they had good imagination. I mean, leave this possibility as well. They're not even considering the possibility of it being some other extinct animal like a dodo or, you know, my cat. Because this creature, he's sleeping and he's still looking at me. And now his hand is suspended. I wish this podcast has like a video, because then I would have just focused the video on my cat as he was licking his balls and, you know, like staring at me. He's licking himself again. Anyway. Okay. I don't even feel like addressing this news anymore because it's stupid and dinosaurs existed. We all know that. The second news is Prince Harry's new job title means penis in Japanese. There are no accidents. Though the article says congratulations to him, but it's getting attention for the wrong reasons in Japan. And the wrong reason that it got attention on this podcast is because I wanted to make a fun Master Uke meme, and here's the news. And that's it. You know, he's actually called the chief impaling officer. And I was like, yeah, in no language that sounds nice. And if the Japanese have translated it to penis according to this weird ass website, I'm pretty sure it's wrong, but it gives me a reason to make the meme. So yeah, thank you. The next news is people are stealing Legos. Here's why. Okay, let's see why. Lego larceny may have been on rise. The French police have been investigating an international ring of toy thieves with a particular affinity for the colorful interlocking bricks, according to a recent report from The Guardian. First, there was a Josh versus Josh fight. Now there's an international ring of toy thieves stealing Lego bricks. I mean, where does it stop? Donald Trump getting re-elected as the United Nations... Oh, maybe the president or the United Nations Peace Corps person or getting a Nobel fucking Peace Prize. Okay, no, that went too far. No one's that kiddish, right? But you guys did vote for him. So moving on, the article further states, in this case, three suspects were caught taking... Oh, my cat is eating food finally. In this case, three suspects were caught taking boxes of Legos from a toy shop near Paris with the goal of selling them in Poland, according to Les Parisiens. Smuggling drugs makes sense. Not that I promote smuggling or taking drugs, though I do want to take weed. Like today I was having a conversation with somebody. I was like, I really need to try weed. I really, really, really need to try weed. But that person, since it was a non-disappearing conversation, they're like, yeah, I'm not going to reply to that, but weed is nice, you should go for it, and I want to go for it. But yeah, I want to do what? Hit me up if you, with your person, I don't know. So anyway, but I do not, like, you know, I am going on record saying that I want weed, but that means I have not taken weed, so you cannot possibly arrest me on anything, you know. But these people really sound like some of those wannabe teenage criminals. And they're like, okay, we have nothing else to steal. So you know what? Let's steal Lego bricks. Oh my God, what else will this podcast make me do other than, like, you know, say that drugs are nice, I want weed, and then other things. But I feel like such a dick. Or I want a dick. Do I? Never mind. Talking about dicks, let's move on to Out of the Blue and talk about the athletic vaginas of Hawaii. But before that, let's take an ad break. Hello, I hope you enjoyed that little ad break. And I was just thinking, after taking a little pause, that I should rant with you guys about everything. And, you know, I have had the anxiety thing that has, like, basically killed me. Not killed me, about to. And not really about to as well. Okay, whatever. So my entirety of my keyboard and the sides of my laptop, they're basically, you know, a weird white patchy thing, because that's how much my hands are sweating. And I cannot clean it, because the moment that I clean it off, more thing appears in like 10 minutes, because that's how sweaty my hands are. So if you know some deodorant people who would like a podcaster to do an advertisement for them, I can do that, and that would be my pitch, that my hands have stopped being sweaty after using deodorant from XYZ. Use code KOYONAIR. Yeah, yeah, please pitch me. Anyway, to the proper out of the blue, we are going to talk about the athletic vaginas of Hawaii. But okay, first, wow, these legends. This sounds silly, but if you read them and actually try to read them, they're like, okay, something is wrong with the humans on the whole. These people are smart, but something is wrong with everybody else. And so the story that I'm going to tell you today is, oh my God, it's called Anxious Pleasures, the sexual lives of an Amazonian people. How does that word, how, okay, the name of the book does not make sense. It's by Thomas Gregor. So most of the books that I found talked about this specific story, and basically either they were verbatim copied from this book with a very weird sexual lives of an Amazonian people, of the Amazonian people, which should, what the fuck? I'm getting annoyed. I copied the names from Google, so I do not think it's supposed to be wrong. Anyway, moving on. So I believe he copied it from a lot of people, or a lot of people copied it from him, but I have verbatim copied it from his book, page number 72 and the 73rd page. And it says, in ancient times, the heading is The Traveling Vaginas. And it says, in ancient times, all women's vaginas used to wander about. Today, women's vaginas stay in one place. One woman of the ancient times, Tukvi, had a vagina that was especially foolish. While Tukvi slept, her vagina would crawl about to the floor of the house, thirsty and hungry, looking for menoic porridge and fish stew. I should not dramatize this. Creeping about snail-like on the ground with her pussy, it found the porridge pot and slid the top off. One of the men awoke and listened. Ah, it's nothing but a mouse, he said, and went back to sleep. But as the vagina slurped up the porridge, another man woke and took a brand from the fire to see what is happening. What is this? He said to him as he looked at the great frog with a nose and an immense mouth. I like how they've compared a vagina to a fucking frog. Go girls, that's how you decriminalize women's sexual things. Okay, moving closer, he scorched the vagina with his torch and it scurried back to its owner, slipping right inside her. That's what they said. She cried and cried, for she had been burned. Then Tukvi called out to all the women and lectured them. All you women, listen, don't let your genitals wander around. If they do, they may get burned as mine were. And so today's women genitals no longer go wandering around. And stop. Okay, honestly, when I read it for the very first time, I was laughing when I read it right now. It's weird, it's creepy, and it's just, oh my God. Imagine vaginas walking around. How beautiful that would be. And imagine dicks and vaginas both walking around. And assholes, because like anal is a thing. And assholes anyway walk around all the time. And dicks also walk around all the time. And vaginas also walk around all the time. This is from where the actual words and the abuses came out. Yes, Discovery. But on a serious note, imagine this. There's a vagina. Or I'd rather say a woman who's walking around at night being weird and fun about things. She's hunting for food. Sounds like a pretty independent vagina, no? But, okay. This vagina also visits a lot of houses of random people and slurps into their food and like has time of their life. Sounds like a society where women have a very active sexual life and there's polygamy, kind of, unless otherwise stated, and they are living their best life. Then this was stopped because there was some asshole who burned a vagina and created a lot of mess. which will created a fucking loads lot of mess. Now, okay, imagine a society which has texts like this everywhere, and trust me, everywhere they have a lot of texts like these. Would they actually provide you know, how do I say, like, would they say that because a woman got burned, their vagina stopped wandering about? One would like to ask what happened that they created this mindset for men such assholes even in the prehistoric times. Then moreover, this text is translated from the story of the, I'm gonna butcher the word, I'm really sorry, I was not able to find a pronunciation for it. Tweet at me if you do. Mehinaku people. And like, it's a society where people are talking about sex, and then suddenly they give the moral of the story, don't let your vagina wander off at night, which kind of does make sense. But that also makes, kind of implies that women should not walk around at night and be concerned with where the vagina gets to lick, whatever. But yes. And look it up. Look about these interesting legends. I remember the last time that I recorded a legend that was the Korean legend about people coming in your noses and like blocking it. I was gonna say something smart that, oh my god, that had such a philosophical interesting meaning to it, and while speaking I was like, yeah, no it does not, that was just gross. But yeah, this one was actually interesting, and it let me think about how much the sexual thing is, I don't know, criminalized for no good reason just because you have a vagina. Let my vagina out. I want it to walk around with the people, with the world. Free the vagina. I just realized I do not have a vagina, so I cannot like really promote. I cannot say free my vagina. Free your own vagina, free my asshole or my dick, and both. Free me. I need freedom. Anyway, there's another story which I would like you guys to hear, and if possible, just send it to me. What do you think about it? So I can rant about that in the validation episode. Is it's about a demigod, a pig demigod, who forced a woman to throw her vagina like a boomerang. A goddess to throw her vagina like a boomerang. Read that up. It's actually very popular and a lot of people have talked about it. So hit me up. Talking about pigs and men, the next story is actually called Boar. And my cat is like literally massaging a pillow in front of me, and I'm like, yes, I did not strangle myself. But my cat is massaging the pillow with his eyes closed. I am gonna go have, not fun with him, I'm gonna go kiss him on his nose because he's so cute, and I'm gonna record the rest of it after 50. I uploaded a story on Instagram like a proud cat mom. Yeah, I'll go with cat mom. I don't know, cat dad suit me. I'm not daddy material, I'm more mommy material. Whatever. oh, I coughed on camera on podcast. You're gonna get corona now. By the way, I'm fine. I'm recovering for, because nobody really asked me after my previous rant about having corona. I got COVID, people gave me attention. The story is called Boar. And the date that I've given is 4th May 2001. The time is 8:04. The whiter, I was gonna say the tender white lilies. And I'm gonna go with that. The tender white lilies on the whiter tiles are laden as if a wedding venue. Why do they even keep things white? There's a little video I've been watching on repeat, where these amazing women are walking down the runway. They are moving their bodies, they're having fun. Every day in the morning, I watch that clip. It makes me wanna be so liberated in my own confines. It is beautiful. I wish I were that beautiful. By the way, like a segue from the story, that this video is actually from the Vienna Fashion Week, and the models were Nigerian models, and oh my fucking god, they ripped about the show. They were so good. And yeah, continuing with the story. I took a deep sigh as it turned right front of the end of the corridor where the animals lie. I saw what I see every day, a bristle of colors, chattering and oppression. Lies and lives, all caught up, being consumed. I love the vibe of the story. Who wrote it, I wonder? I did. Wait, what did I just think? That didn't even make a lot of sense. Nevertheless, I thought I should write it. I just realized how my commentaries and how the stories are actually on the exact same vibe. And this is a commentary, and there was another commentary where who wrote it? I did. So, but like, where, what did I just think? It did not even make a lot of sense. Nevertheless, I should write it in case I ever need it as a part of the story. I came closer to my locker. I took out a little square notepad, pressed the button on my pencil to expose the graphite, and let the words flow. I like my thoughts sometimes, you know. People think it makes me either a dumb fart or it makes me an evil fart. Talking about farts, I mean, I'd rather not talk about farts. So moving on, I felt him walking towards me, you know, when I was writing. That is why perhaps I swiftly finished the musing over my own self and hit the note back into the abyss where it came from. Hey, I should write this down too, I thought. I knew his red-pink hands will now come grab me on my shoulder, jerk it a little, and then shove it in. That's what he said. And how annoying are red pink hands? A lot of times when I am watching any series, I just get so distracted by red pink hands of Caucasian people. I don't know why they have such pink hands. Pink hands look very cute on me. And I think that's why I want no other man in the entire universe to have red pink hands, because I look fucking cute in them. So only I can have them. Anyway, he jerked it and shoved it in the shoulder. The cold iron digged itself into my cheek. I knew this would happen. I was well prepared for it. Hey, Koi, he said. Ooh, also, I read somewhere that it's Koi according to the Japanese pronunciation, and Koi is the American pronunciation, but I like Koi more. So yeah, we're gonna go with Koi because it's my name. I chose it. It's Koi now. He said as he released my shoulder, his grin almost touched his ears. Hey, I was gonna say, but why, I must be allowed to speak. I have something really cool planned out for us today. You will just love it, he said. I nodded as I swallowed my own saliva. He now, with his left hand, grabbed my crotch, pressed on it very hard. It did almost bring tears to my eyes, and he just laughed and went to stride on the hallway like he owns it. Well, I wouldn't be surprised if he did. I could feel the blood rushing down there when he touched me. Maybe, I don't know. I liked it. This little routine of mine, of ours. Every day, he makes me feel human and accepted. I saw him throwing something from his bag in the trash can in front of the girl's toilet. I swiftly closed the locker door and ran to see it. It was a ball of tissues which was, well, soaked in blood. Did he steal tampons? God, I really don't want to meet him later. Has my storytelling skills become better than before? Did I just get into the character? I just realized I got into the character. So the entirety of this story. Oh, I'm going to comment on the story later on. But no, the entirety of the story is basically kind of thoughts of this guy who keeps on thinking a lot, stays a lot in his head, which basically describes me. And so in a way, the story is of me in a hypothetical situation. 4th May 2001. Time 13:04. You know, I do not know when usually it was the time for lunch when I was in school. And I tried to open, like, I tried to research on it on Google, and it did not really turn up a lot of things. So I do not know if this is the correct lunchtime, but that's the time that I'm having brunch nowadays. So there's that. Anyway, 13:04 is the time on the same day. I was looking at my tray of uneaten food. I wish dogs were around me. I would have fed them my lunch every day. This is annoying. Gawking at it, I felt Carp looking at me again. I felt his chair as he pushed it back to make way for his heavy feet. He came to my table. The junior, who was sitting two seats right to me, saw him coming, stood up and ran as if it was their blood on the tissue ball. Carp bent down. He placed his face very close to mine and put a paper in on the tray, which had the tape, the paper had tape running around it. He made a little pout and blew a kiss at me and went to follow the junior with the blue tea, the one who ran away. He had a weird jump in his walk. I knew this was not right. I opened the little paper, rather tore the thing. What kind of genius even tapes paper to seal it? When they are the one who is basically the first person who's delivering it. On the paper, it said, attic, comma, 5. I took a breath in, let another out, and Carp's voice rang in my head. The universe is all about give and take. You take a breath in, you let a breath out. You let go here with our hearts set to set the order in the world. I threw the food which was in the tray. Let go. You know, this is actually, I've inspired this from Marissa Peer's meditations. She's always says, breathe in, breathe out. It's a relationship that you have with the universe. And I thought, why not like scar all the yogi traditions by putting this in this story inspired by this specific Chicago Crew true crime story? And let's just scar everything in and out. In and out. Okay, that can sound so sexual. I heard a song today which is all about, like, it's not moans actually. They just go like, ah. And oh wow, I just moaned on the fucking podcast. What's wrong with me? It's like a very, very cool song. I'm gonna play it after the end of the end credits. Yeah, I'm gonna do that. And I'm gonna tell the, I should probably tell the name right now, but I do not remember the name. Every other credits for that specific song will come right there at the end. So you'll have to listen to the entire freaking episode to listen to people moan, but okay. 4th May 2001. 17:04. I liked how I did not change the timestamps, like all the minutes are in 04 in case you have not noticed it yet. And I continue reading. There was something about how this house smelled. This earthy lavender and vanilla. It had a vaginal fragrance. The rest of them called it. I wouldn't know. When I climbed up to his attic, I felt my soul leaving my body. Goosebumps spread all over it. I looked with the side of my eye and saw myself there at the door. I saw Carp and the others looking at my soul. With their gaze, I knew it would leave it all and leave me behind. I walked in the room, the center was. In the center, there was a little hand. I knew by the hair on it, it was the one, it belonged to the one in the blue tee, the one who got away. It looked kind of fantastic. It was wrapped in his t-shirt, well. It complemented the blue of the altar and the golden of the pentagrams. I did not want to do this, but I know it for a fact. His soul left his body like mine left mine. Now, what we'll do, we'll feast on the hand. Dun, 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 dun. yeah, that's the story. They ate a boy's hand. So I actually do not like how this story ended. I wish it was longer, but I was actually not able to write anything more because when I was trying to do anything creative, I just feel like a failure and not being able to like actually do anything well. So I ended it a little early than I originally intended it to. But yeah, here's the story. Though originally I wanted the story to be set in a prehistoric landscape of 18,500 before Christ, and it was gonna be about the evolution of pigs and how that happened and somehow put this death into that, just because I wanted to equate the criminals of the said true crime of the said crimes to pigs, because yeah, but that was a very bad idea and I did not go with it for two basic reasons. A, I did not know how to. B, it was a fucking bad idea. I just did not realize it. So here's the story, which was originally something else. But yeah, moving on to the true crime inspiration of this. It is an 11-page long document. Okay, let's dive right into it. Okay, so the first reported case was on 1st June 1981 when the police got a call for a corpse at the Moonlit Hotel, Villa Park, Chicago. Now, this area is filled with junky shops, bars, and basically it's very shady. So a call like this, the police was like, all right, maybe it's another OD victim or something like that. The hotel worker who actually found this is, according to the J. Slade Fletcher, a woman person who has reported this case very well, a Chicago detective, says that the maid reported a terrible odor and the manager of the place went in to check the nearby trash area expecting a dead animal or something. What he found was the corpse of what remained of what basically looked like bones and some flesh on them. When the cops came, they deduced that the body was most probably dead for a very long time because the decomposition was so severe that it was exposing the skeletal structure and the dogs have decided to start to bark. But the maggots, despite like being decomposed to that extent, the maggots were still there having a buffet, which is kind of unusual. Now I read, like I went deep, that's what they said while researching. So what they said that when flies lay eggs on bodies, the eggs hatch under 24 hours, then the first cycle is about 4 to 5 days long. I mean, what they found on the body was mostly the first stage maggots, so it meant that they came on the body 3 to 4 days or maybe maximum 5 days, but the body was in a very bad state considering the amount of decomposition in the bone and the tissue that was visible. Though, despite finding the body in this condition, the police was able to deduce that she was murdered as they saw handcuffs on her, a cloth that was used as gag. She was wearing a sweater and underwear, which was pulled down to her thigh. Now, while researching, and this is something which enraged me beyond anything, they kept on using the word panty in all the articles because, oh my god, it was so annoying. Like, you know, there's a lot of wrong when it comes to using the word panty, and throughout this case most of these articles were like written in the early 2000s or the 1900s, like in the 90s, in the 80s, and I do not think that people at that time were sensitive, so I don't mind that, but this was like annoying me and gave me a headache. So also the victim's socks had a wad of dollar there, so the robbery couldn't have been a motive. And now, because of obvious reason, it was basically next to impossible to ID her right away, which also like Which, and it also took time to establish it, and it was also difficult to establish the time of the crime. My head is all over the place right now. With the lack of adequate technology, all the estimations and the information that they were able to gather, as it was purely anecdotal. Investigators also needed to establish whether this was a primary crime scene where she, that means if this is where she was killed, or is it a secondary crime scene, that is she was killed elsewhere and the body was dumped here. The fact that nobody really reported the body indicated that the body was not there for long, but if you think like that, it also implied that somebody had to carry basically a body which is falling apart on its own and tolerate the decomposing remains long enough to carry it and place it at the site. One thing the detectives knew they could check was the soil beneath her body to determine whether the body fluids had leached into it. When they delivered the body to the deputy coroner, Pete Seichman, so that he can attempt to determine the cause and the manner of death, as well as take fingerprints, teeth impressions to compare the records if any existed. A search of missing people reports turned up to no leads, so the detective called the Chicago department, who told them that the practice of rolling money inside the socks probably indicated that the woman was a sex worker or a stripper. The word that they used in the articles was hooker, again, wrong word. Anyway, this basically meant that being able to identify her would be even more difficult. However, in 2 weeks, they were able to do it thanks to the dental records and the fingerprints that they found. She was Linda Sutton. She was 21 years old. She was a sex worker, mother of 2 children, and a repeat offender. Despite having the advanced state of decomposition of the body, they were also able to determine that she was dead only for 3 days. The remains advanced rate of decomposition was due to two large wounds under her breasts, where her breasts were removed, which had allowed an invasion of parasites, and the woman had been brutally assaulted and mutilated and most probably raped. Now, after over an year, on 12th February, some things about these guys: they had 18 total victims, which included, I believe, 2 men, and rest of them were women. They had a certain thing. So the next that I was able to find reliable sources on, and I underlined reliable sources, is that of 12th February 1982, when a 35-year-old cocktail waitress was abducted from her car. The gauge which was found the gauge showed that the tank was empty, implying that she had run out of the gas and probably was looking for help. Her purse was on the front seat, the keys were still in the ignition, and when they started to begin the search around the car, a naked body on an embankment near the road was found. The body showed sign of rape, torture, and mutilation. The press was asked not to report that the breasts of this woman was amputated, according to Billy Kelly from Homicidal Mania, which is an amazing source, by the way, such that the police could retain that detail for the interrogation process. Then again, a few days later, a Hispanic woman wearing an engagement ring was discovered, raped, strangled. Her breasts were not removed this time, but they had been bitten rather badly. I mean, talk about creativity. Her killer had also masturbated over her body, and a psychiatric assessment of this crime pegged the attacker to be a local man who probably, and I quote, loved animals and had a family. You know, that loved animals part made my mind go so many places, and that was the reason why I wrote the boar story. Because originally I was not thinking of killing the junie, I was thinking of bringing in a cat whose balls that they were eating at the altar in the attic, and that cat was supposed to be Koi's cat, but then I was like, no, I cannot subject my own cat to that kind of torture even in my imagination. So I killed a human being in the story. Yes. Then again in May, Lorraine Bobrovsky, or Laurie Ann, her given name, was abducted from where she worked as she was crossing the parking lot. She was repeatedly raped. Then a wire was wrapped around her breast to sever it from her body. The wire was, according to some sources, a piano wire. Then one of her attackers killed her with a hatchet. The woman's remains were discovered at the dump site, which was in the same general area as that of Sutton, and had been, and I quote, dumped, although this time it was in a cemetery as known as the Caledron Hills. So I think they were trying to be kind of respectful, unlike these fucking dogs who keep on barking. Just 2 weeks after Bobrovsky, Shui Mark was abducted on May 29th as she was returning home from her family restaurant in Streamboat. Now, her thing was that she was actually in her brother's car and they fought. And that guy, he just dropped her off on the road at that time, that I don't want to deal with you, and asked for the other relatives who were, according to him, trailing her to like pick her up and get her home. However, that did not happen. She was abducted. Her body was discovered 4 months later in the end of August, buried at a construction site where she had been mutilated in the similar manner as other women. And reading this made me imagine how would that brother had felt after this, and how would those relatives have felt that they fought over something and the last thing that they fought, like last thing that they did was fight, and the relatives didn't pick her up or like burn there, whatever. But oh my god, that is so much to think and process. It just shakes me to my core. Now, like obviously the crimes had an obvious, gruesome, specific pattern. However, still the police was having a very difficult time finding any leads. Then a victim turned up, that was Angel York, who survived, according to Howard and Smith. She reported that two men who were in a red van abducted her, held her inside using handcuffs. They forced her to use a large knife to cut her own breast, which drove one of the men into a frenzy. He cut her more, then he masturbated into the wound and then closed it with a duct tape and dumped her into the street. This happened in June 1987, and she allegedly lived to tell the tale. Now, despite having a probable surviving victim, the police was not able to curb the crimes or generate a lead. Then in August, a woman called Sandra Delaware was found dumped along the side of the Chicago River. Her wrists were bound together behind her with a shoelace. Her left wrist had been removed in the same fashion as the prior victims. The bra was knotted around her throat. She was a kid, you know. She was a teenager who worked as a sex worker. They estimated her death happened 6 hours earlier and before the body was found. Now, listen, like this is something weird, but earlier the bodies were being found 3 days, 2 days after the entire thing. So the police kind of was working, but just not working fast enough. Their patrolling was better that they were now able to find women at least earlier, though not able to save them. So they are improving, kind of. They could have done a better job in that, but still, kudos. 2 weeks after this, Carol Pappas, 42, she turned up missing, along with Rose Beck Davis, who was 30, and a marketing executive. She was found stabbed, raped, strangled on September 8, 1982, behind a stairway of a North Lake Shore apartment building. The black socks, there was a black sock which was tied around her neck, and her clothing was in disarray. Her face was crushed, the blood pooled behind her, and it was found that she was beaten with a hatchet, Deep cuts were visible on her breast and her abdomen was full of small punctures. You know, I'm not sure if it was this woman that I found a picture of, that one of their victims, their corpse's picture that I saw, it had the front jaw which was broken because it, like, that's how badly it was punched. But it was so, so freaking badly punched that the back of her skull actually got crushed with the, because of the impact. And, okay, and now in October, another sex worker, Beverly Washington, aged 20, was mutilated, raped, and dumped. However, she survived and was taken to the hospital. According to some sources that I read, she was actually found by a jogger. You know, joggers actually saved lives. I realized a lot of women have been found by joggers and then saved. She, Beverly, the survivor, she gave descriptions of the gang men who abducted her and subjected her to the sadistic sexual assault. Robert Reiser, who was from the FBI's behavioral science unit, was asked to profile the criminals, and he concluded that one of them, maybe the head, is a queer man with who is perhaps effeminate. Now, Beverly Washington was a breakthrough. She provided the officers with several significant characteristics about the man who attacked her. She said that the driver was a slender white man who looked around 25, wearing a flannel shirt and square-toed boots. He had greasy brown hair and a mustache. Washington said that that guy offered her more money than she asked for, and was extremely nervous. When he asked to get into the back of the van with him, she saw a gun there. He ordered her to remove her clothes and she obeyed. Then he placed handcuffs on her, forced her to perform oral sex on him, and then threatened her that he's gonna kill her if she did not swallow a handful of pills that he was giving to her. As she passed out, she saw him holding a cord over her body, and she just knew that she was gonna die there. The man dumped her into trash with one breast completely severed and the other one nearly severed, but someone discovered her and called the police. She was rushed to the hospital, and once she was in the condition to answer questions, the police asked, and she said it was a red van, that it was a red van, and there was a wooden divider inside there and feathers and a roach clip hung from the rear view mirror. Within 3 weeks, on October 20, 1982, according to Howard Smith, according to Kelly, she says it's November 7, and Fletcher says it's October 5th, the police pulled over a red van and questioned the driver. The driver had red hair and did not resemble the victim's description, but the van fit right in. The driver told them that his name was Eddie Spritzer, and the van belonged to his boss, Robin Gitt. Gitt, I think. It's G-E-C-H-T, so Gitt. I am not sure. I should have looked up how to pronounce that too. The officers directed Eddie to Robin's house and had him call Robin out. They hoped that this would be the guy, and when he came out, it was. He was wearing the same shirt and the boots, but he acted like he had like no worries. He was like, oh my God, I'm innocent. I do not know what you're talking about. He was arrogant, confident, and knew that he was untouchable. Later, the victim, Elizabeth, Beverly picked Robin Gitt out of a set of photos that she saw, and when detectives went back to question him, Gitt was with a lawyer. He was a tough cookie. He was very difficult to shake up. According to some sources, he had an interesting association with notorious criminals from the areas and was also arrested 3 years early. Not three, yeah, 3 years early in 1979. Within 2 weeks, the investigators were able to link the survivor, the other survivor, Angel York, with Beverly's red van. The police initially believed that Robin and Eddie were the perpetrators of at least three incidents. At first, they did not speak anything, but eventually Eddie Splitzer broke down and he seemed to be genuinely afraid of Robin Gitt. He succumbed, feeling guilty. Eddie's interrogation A blew the socks off the police officers and produced a 70-page statement. Splitzer first admitted to driving the van with Robin and committed a drive-by shooting in which a man died and another was left paralyzed. These were the two victims that I told you about. Investigators were quickly able to identify the incident, and then Eddie said that Robin directed him to slow down to pick up a colored sex worker. Robin had sex with her and then took her into an alley and removed her breast using a knife. He placed the breast on the van floor, and Eddie says that he was quite upset when he spelled out these details and when he saw all this happening, and he said, "I do not like blood." I mean, yeah, I'm so sorry for that. But then he said that Robin sometimes had sex with the amputated breast right there, and that he also described how Robin shot another woman in her head, chained her up, and used bowling balls to weigh her down in water. He believed that her body was not found. According to what he told Jennifer Fruyo in a Serial Killer Letters, which was actually a book that she wrote later in the prison, like long, long, long time back, he said that he saw Robin batter a woman with a hammer. This sight made him vomit. But on another woman, he removed a breast himself, cutting off both. He thought that she was dead when he did it, but he did not try to find out for certain. And there are actually reports which say that a lot of women got their breasts amputated and the entire thing while they were alive, and they were just left for the dead. He said that Robin had forced him to have sex with the gaping wounds of the women. By the time Splitzer finished, he offered details for 7 outright murders and 1 aggravated battery. His interrogators were obviously shaken by the aberrant nature of the acts and yet believed that they had leverage on Robin now, who was in another interrogation room, all cocky and being blameless. They collected the photographs of the known victims and laid it in front of him, and he looked at them without much interest and denied knowing them. The detectives then took him to an area where Eddie said that where Eddie was basically showing things to the officer, you know, but Robin still did not waver. You know, I read this and I want to kill this guy for the things that he has done and the amount of confidence that he had. So when they saw this, the officers were obviously pissed, but Robin's this move actually did not help anybody. Gitt's nearness to Splitzer had a very odd effect, and Eddie started to change his story like a lot, and said that Robin did not murder anybody. His account became so chaotic that his interrogators did not know what to believe anymore. Eddie said that now that it was another man, that was his girlfriend's brother, Andrew Corrales. You know, weird thing that these men actually had relationships with other women, and Robin himself was married. Now, Andrew Corrales, he said, is the killer, but it was not able to give many details on him. But when they found him, they were like, okay. Corrales also confessed. He said that they kidnapped women off the street, raped them, stabbed them with knives, razors, tin can lids and can openers, and used a piano wire to amputate one or both the breast, then masturbated into or on them. And later on, I'm going to tell you more about this amputated breasts and how important it was for these men. He admitted that the murders of Rose Beck Davis, Lauren Bowoski, and inadvertently confessed that he had also been involved in the death of 18 other women. As he described the assault of Sandra Delaware, he said that he was the one who shoved a rock into her mouth to keep her from screaming, forced a wine bottle into her, which made her bleed badly, and then stabbed her with a knife. The autopsy reports of this also confirmed this. Along with these, this actually reminds me of gore porn and how that is a thing, and how I once upon a time actually ended up googling that and saw Google images and I saw two amputated heads, and oh god, yes, and how could these men even do that? I just cannot. Now I need to gather my thoughts. Break. Not an ad break, a break for me to drink water. And you also drink water. Whew. Okay, hi, I am back. I had some water to drink and some time to walk pace around in my room. Along with the interrogations, detectives also started asking acquaintances of the subjects about their characters and their personal habits. It soon became clear that Robin had a breast fetish. He asked girls he knew to stab their breast with pins. He allegedly forced his wife to endure just as much and even more. She even had infected wounds, although she never turned him in. But when detectives started to question everyone, they rounded up, and I quote, his slow-witted brother. The amount of insensitivity throughout these articles ceases to amaze me. Does not cease to amaze me, rather. The brother of this guy, he was called Tommy. His odd behavior indicated that he too was a part of the Ripper crew, and shortly he broke down and confessed, adding more details. It was added by him that these guys were actually into satanic worship, and that this was basically a trending topic in the 80s, yet the Rippers actually were the ones who took it a step further. Robin's associates took the flesh that they had removed from the victims, according to Tommy's confession, cut it up and consumed it as a form of a devilish communion, an ancient practice, as Robin said, for a religion that's like 2000 years old. I do not know what. I should not throw shade at while speaking shit like this, but okay, that's not ancient. The Greeks were ancient. The Titanias were ancient people. But yeah, okay, so this ancient communion ritual that they did. Robin also had an altar in his attic of his Northwest Side home, where he gathered during the evening after hours when his wife was gone. Supposedly, he had painted 6 red and black crosses on the walls and covered the altar in red cloth. Well, the guy had a thing for aesthetics. Tommy told the police that they would all kneel around the altar and Robin would give freshly removed breasts and read passages from the Bible as each man masturbated into the body part. When everyone was finished, Robin would cut the thing up even more and then hand the pieces over to the guys to eat. Tommy even said that he witnessed 2 of the murders himself and did participate in about a dozen such rituals. When the detectives asked him why he did it, he said that Robin told them to. He said that you just have to do it. Apparently, he was convinced that Robin Gitt had some kind of supernatural connection with the devil and was afraid what he might do if they didn't do what he asked them to. After the interrogations, the team killers were held in the Pontiac Correction Center on a $1 million bond on a variety of charges. Robin pleaded not guilty. He worked as a subcontractor for John Wayne Gacy during the 1970s and Gacy, for the people that you do not know, was responsible for killing 33 young men, which I am going to cover soon, and buried their bodies under his house. And according to Robin, that was the only problem with his character and everything about his old boss. He showed no awareness for the wrongness of his brutality and the acts that he did. He just thought that the man had gone the wrong way about hiding his crimes. As the police interviewed more people, that they learned that Eddie and Andrew Corrales were not the only ones who feared Robin Gates and believed his powers. Others also claimed that he had a real ability to draw people in and then do his bidding. One person warned the detectives to never look into Robin's eyes, no matter what, because he will be able to then control them. No matter how sick or disgusting an act was, he just could simply inspire the people to get involved. He actually involved women into his acts and like a dozen other people who came and did shit. I do not know. Some sources also said that he started with molesting his sister, and because of this, he was sent to live with his grandparents, though he denies of this ever happening in the letters that he wrote to Jennifer Fruego for her books. During adolescence, he says that he developed a keen interest in Satanism and the secret rituals. The newspaper grabbed the story and used the headlines that linked the, and I quote, Ripper crew or the Chicago Rippers to the witch. And basically the word Ripper denoted to Jack the Ripper, who actually killed only 3 people, you know, but he's still one of the most notorious people ever, maybe because he was never found. But that's what gave them the name. You know, there's this thing with media that we love to make heroes and give names to such assholes. Like, this is a separate issue which one day I would love to take up in Out of the Blue, note to self. And each member faced their own trial. Now, in the very first trial, Robin Gate attempted to avoid trial by pleading insanity and being unfit for trial. He was, though, evaluated competent to stand trial and was considered sane at the time of the offenses. The first trial that he had was deemed a mistrial, but his second one started in September 20th, 1983. The prosecutor came up with some compelling evidence and in a search, the police was able to find the chapel and a rifle which was used for shooting. Not sure if you guys would be able to hear this bird going, go, go, like, it's 3 a.m., bitch, calm the fuck down. But she's like, speak. Yeah, she just spoke. I don't know. It's fun. It's summers now and there's gonna be peacocks. They're gonna be this random bird and some other birds like chirping 24/7 around me. So welcome to my world. It's actually fun. I like it. Now, the police also found satanic ritual and the trophy box, and I quote, trophy box, which was owned by Robin, which still had over 15 pieces of female breasts. From the victim reports, the MO was detailed to the jury. Women were kidnapped, held against their will, tortured, and impaled with needles and ice picks. They were then gang raped, forced to endure having their breasts sliced off with a wire such that these men can eat them or use them for satanic rituals. Often the victims died, but they felt horrendous pain of mutilation, rape, torture, and so much more before they died. Robin took the stand to speak in his own defense. Some sources report that he admitted to attacking Beverly Washington, but in court, then he suddenly insisted that he had killed no one and was innocent of rape and all the other charges. He even said that he didn't know any of the other guys, despite compelling eyewitness testimonies as well as testimony from the women who claimed that Gait has asked them to cut off their nipples for him. All these confessions and statements were actually not admissible against him because there was no physical evidence linking him to the murder. He could not be prosecuted for any of the killings, and his accomplices were not really willing to testify. However, the jury found Gait guilty on all counts, and he was charged with attempted murder, rape, deviate sexual assault, aggravated battery, and armed violence. He was sentenced to 120 fucking years in prison. Rotten hell, you fucking dart. So, what happened to the rest of them, if in case you were wondering? So, Tommy Corrales, he was 23 and he attempted to block his confession from being admitted into the trial, but lost. He was convicted in 1984 and was sentenced 70 years into the prison for his part in Lorraine Bobrovsky's murder. I like how they convicted these guys for like 70 years, even if they were found guilty on just one murder. You know, that's like amazing. And though Andrew Corrales was tried in two separate counties, the first trial was of that of Rose Beck Davis, and in his confession that he admitted that he had abducted her with the other men and forced her into the van, beaten her with the hatchet until she was dead. The jury deliberated only for 3 hours and then found him guilty of rape and murder and then sentenced him to life in prison. In the second trial, Corrales decided that he wanted to recant everything that he confessed 4 different times and deny that he raped or killed anybody like ever. He claimed that the police had coerced him to make false promises and even beaten him to make sure that he says what they wanted him to say. The prosecutor went through the interrogations performed by 6 separate detectives and 2 other prosecutors, but then Corrales insisted that they told him exactly what to say. He also indicated that the police officers had told him the details of the crime scenes and giving them all that he needed to confess. However, out of obvious reasons, this was, you know, not considered because it was far-fetched. Not all detectives are bad. The jury found Corrales guilty on the account of murder of Lorraine Bobrovsky and sentenced him to death. At his sentencing hearing, he once again denied the charges, and his attorneys argued later, despite the verdict, that the act did not merit death penalty. He fucking amputated the breast of a woman. How is that not worthy of death penalty? You know, I am somebody who generally does not support death penalty, but sometimes I do, and this is one of those sometimes. In addition, a prison chaplain and a counselor testified that Corrales was non-threatening and could be rehabilitated. In addition, Corrales argued that he had received ineffectual counsel at his sentencing in the case of Rose Beck Davis, the first trial, and the offense did not warrant death penalty but life in prison. He insisted that the court had not proven his intent to kill or any degree of premeditation. Nevertheless, the court was like, you know what, shut the fuck up, and basically dismissed his appeals and held the previous sentences. His attorneys again tried a different track and argued that he was suffering from schizophrenia, so that he wouldn't have possibly known what he was doing when he committed the murder. They claimed that the trial lawyers should have entered an insanity defense, but had not, and that he was not psychiatrically evaluated, which was actually a significant oversight. All right, once this became a thing, a psychiatric diagnosis was actually done, and they found that he had a borderline personality disorder and found him, but that did not mean that he was incompetent to stand trial. This diagnosis did not make him insane, and it was a very weak argument, but they did say that he was vulnerable to a very strong influence and therefore not entirely responsible for what he had done. But when the district judge queried the trial attorneys about these issues, they claimed that no pattern or aberrant behavior had made anyone new. The defendant suspect a psychiatric disorder, and this basically satisfied the judge that the pending affidavit was unpersuasive. Yet the appeals of the attorneys pointed that the bizarre behavior of Tommy was basically the proof of his condition. But in a 41-page opinion, the court said that it found it not to be an reversible error and affirmed the sentence again. Finally, the guy we've all been waiting for, actually not, I'm pretty sure most of you forgot about him, Andrew Corrales, the girlfriend's boyfriend, Eddie's sister's boyfriend. Or girlfriend's brother, fuck yes, it was Eddie's girlfriend's brother. He was scheduled to be executed on 17th March 1999, but the political environment in Illinois at the time was weird. The governor, George Ryan, and the Supreme Court Justice Moses Harrison was persuaded to stay the order for execution for him, and moratorium was called on all executions in Illinois. In fact, thanks to a series of crusading articles in the Chicago Tribune about the injustices in the legal system, 12 people had recently been exonerated and removed from the death row, which was basically trouble and shook the governor. Some of these were exonerated on basis of DNA evidence, others were exonerated on revelations of poor handling by the legal system. One case in particular, that was of Anthony Potter, was especially disturbing. Potter was a colored man, or a black man, of IQ of 51, according to the American Spectator, and he was in prison for 16 years for double homicides. After exhausting his appeals, he was waiting execution on September 23, 1998, but a Northwestern University professor and a death penalty abolitionist had turned up with evidence in the case. So 2 days before the execution, the stay was ordered. Another man confessed to the crime. It was clear proof that the state had prosecuted and imprisoned an innocent man and was about to put him to death. Now, despite all, he did die. Okay, on the morning before his execution, Andrew was convinced that it was not going to happen. He was flown to a super maximum security prison in Tamas, Illinois, and he spent the rest of the day praying and fasting. It was actually late for you to pray and fast, my love, but then again, Jesus is all forgiving. He spoke to a selected few friends on his phone. He bid them farewell with his brother, who was not Tommy, and like his other brother. He prayed and cried, yet Andrew believed that there can be a last-minute pardon. When he was strapped onto the gunnery, he offered Bavosky's family an apology and said that the kingdom of heaven was at hand, and then received the lethal injection at 12:34 p.m. My cat is eating food, so if in the background it feels like there are fireworks or somebody is like getting crushed, it's him crushing his food. Andrew happened to be the last person to be executed before Governor Ryan in January 2000 enforced a moratorium on all executions. Now, back to Eddie Spitzer. He pleaded guilty on April 2nd, 1984, to murdering Rose Davis, Sandra Delaville, Shui Mark, and a drug dealer named Rafael Torado. He received life sentences for each murder, as well as time for multitude of charges from rape to deviant sexual assault, yet he still had to go to trial for Linda Sutton's murder. He appeared in the bench trial in front of Judge Edward Covell in February 25th, 1986, but retained his right to have a jury decide his sentence. He admitted that he and his comrades abducted Linda. I read the word comrades and I'm like, communist manifesto and shit, but okay. Linda Sutton, and said that she was walking near the Ringley field, and he took her to a wooden field area near the hotel he was staying, and then handcuffed her, raped her, removed her breasts, and then raped her again and left her to die. His defender, Carol Anfison, I just feel that how difficult would it be to defend such a man, especially for another woman, presented him, so this Carol presented him to be immature, impulsive, simplistic, a young man just following orders of a gang leader. She asked the jury to spare his life. In his support, his relatives and associates testified that he was a docile young man with a history of being bullied. And my character is actually kind of based on Eddie, the character in my story. And yeah, the ADA, though, insisted that Splitzer was every woman's nightmare, and that he was one of the pack of weasels and he should basically die. His bid for mercy failed to work. He was convicted on March 4th for aggravated kidnapping and murder. 2 weeks later, on March 20, the jury deliberated for an hour and gave him death penalty. He wound up on the death row in Pontiac State Correction Facility in Joliet, Illinois. Now he had another attorney who was called Gary Pichard, and he said that his and he claimed that Eddie's IQ was very low, that it was 76, and he had a troubled history, making him instrumental and very easy to be manipulated by a person like Robin. However, as quoted in the Daily Herald, the people viewed him as personification of evil, and his crimes were considered worst of the worst. Now, as I've mentioned this before, Jennifer Froyo devised a project of writing letters to serial killers. The guy was convicted, and like Eddie was convicted despite all. Moving on from that to the next interesting thing that happened in this entire case, that was Jennifer Froyo. Now, she decided to send written letters to serial killers and see how they would respond. She sent to Robin Gett, Eric Splitzer, and they sent her letters back, which she put her in her book, Serial Killer Letters. When Eddie first came, Froyo said that he had turned himself in case when the case was initially investigated. However, he did not, so delusional. He told her that he felt badly about his involvement in the crimes and even passed out at the sight of blood, but insisted that he'd done it because he was afraid of Robin and his shotgun. He quoted that, "I never did bad things alone." And yeah, Jennifer excuses him for being weak, vulnerable, directionless, illiterate, and an easy target thanks to a bad home life and substance abuse. Robin, however, offered this guy a job, which was down to his lung, which was basically a good thing for him, you know. According to Eddie, Robin blackmailed him with obscene photographs that he had of him, that he will send it to police. And yeah, Jennifer actually thought that this guy was sweet and gentle and failed to come across as a murderer. What he had hoped for during the time that he had left before the execution, that these letters were to be published and that he finds the love of a good woman, preferably someone who would marry him. He insisted that the murders were not planned, instead they were random attacks. He had driven the van and Robin ordered him to stop whenever he saw a woman who appealed to him. He said that he was on the lookout for women with sizable breasts. He said that the Cruellis brothers were also forced to do things and they did not really know what to do, but yet again he did not also know them all too well to actually save from this debt. Jennifer was actually very curious about Robin's obsession with women's breasts, and he told her it was a thing with his entire family. He said that from his great-grandfather onwards, each male member of his family married a woman with very large breasts. He expressed great satisfaction that his former wife had a size 39B, and I wish I would have killed this man again. I wished I fed him rat poison with my own frickin' hands. Now, he insisted, Robin insisted, that he was not a serial killer and he had no part in the crimes in his letters, that he never murdered anybody, that the things that were printed about him in the newspapers and the books were all a result of a stupid joke which got repeated again and again until the people believed it. He claimed that the primary book on the subject had been biased by the police, and he also informed her that two of her charges had been dropped and that he would be released from the prison sooner than expected. However, his persistent bid for DNA testing was stymied over and over again. Now, this guy was basically a Menosk type of killer, which is basically a person who persuaded other people to kill for him. According to the three confessions, Robin was exactly this. While Menos's brood was larger, three men who followed Robin were just as deadly. It's quite unusual for four people to be involved in such extensive string of sexually sadistic murders. Eric W. Hickley, a criminologist who published a study involving 300 serial killers, offered a line in the serial murders and their victims that they appropriate this for the crew. For some multiple killers, the murders must be simultaneously a participation and a spectator endeavor. Power can be experienced by observing a fellow conspirator destroy human life, possibly as much as by performing a killing. Pathology of the relationship operates symbiotically. The killers add to each other's excitement. That's what he is basically trying to say in fancy words. Perhaps that's why they did not really do it alone, but it was the chemistry of theirs which made them do these things. Now, according to a study that I found, 74% of the dream killers were white. Female killers also participated with the men around 1/3 of the time, that is in 6 murders. The majority of the cases involved only 2 offenders working together. Of the serial killer murders, some 15% were team-based, and the victims in most of the cases were strangers. Sometimes they say the team leader or the dominant partner sended the other person to do what they wanted, and sometimes they participated. One person always maintained psychological control over the other people. That was personified by me, by leaving their soul on the door. Okay, yeah, this is the case of Chicago Ripper Crew. Okay, thanks, bye. To lighten up the mood, I am gonna play the morning song in the end, a little bit of it, just the starting of it. The podcast is brought to you by Koyonair, who's abso-fucking-lutely uncomfortable and is questioning why I even do this podcast. It is co-produced with Nifix, which I, my producer, who's amazing. The music is by Lil Addy, who is, I believe, now a 17-year-old, and I do not know why I associated him to this podcast wherein I talk about all these things, but he is an amazing person and is fucking talented. You can follow me on Koi On Air on Twitter and Instagram. I'm not very active on Twitter, but I'm trying to be more active there, so please follow me there. And that's it. Roll the ending music and then the morning song. Okay, so there's an actual playlist on my Spotify called Moans, and this is the song in it. I love this song. It was weird. I was actually playing this on like loudspeaker while I was taking a bath. Yeah. Yeah. This is the song. Listen to it. Absorb it. Hear it. And it's 3 a.m. and I'm actually playing this for you guys. And my cat now look is like literally staring at me. Yeah. Yeah. It has a good vibe to it once you start listening. Yeah. Okay, that's it. Okay. Fine. This song is actually called Parchia for 8 Singers Number 3 Kurante. It is sung by Caroline Shaw, Room Full of Teeth, and Brad Wills. The album art for this is amazing and I love this song. That is my effort to make the story feel lighter. Okay, bye.